The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, scientists are continuing their celestial search for dark matter from an underground facility in South Dakota. We'll visit a native plant farm in upstate New York, and we'll celebrate the return of Friday Night Lights at a new field in Massachusetts. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Scientists are hunting for dark matter. It's believed to be an invisible building block of the universe, but direct evidence of dark matter has yet to be confirmed. The Lux Zeppelin Project, or LZ, is the most sensitive dark matter detector in the world. The underground detector in South Dakota is operated by scores of international scientists, including our next guest, Matthew Sudeikis, a physics professor at the University at Albany.
So we don't know what dark matter is, but we do have lots of evidence, observational evidence from astronomy, from astrophysics and cosmology, that suggests that there's a lot of unseen matter that has a gravitational impact. And so that ties into the holding together part you were talking about. So dark matter is some form of matter that is not part of the standard model of particle physics. So it's not composed of protons, neutrons, and electrons like you and me. And we know this because if it was, then it would have more prominent interactions through electromagnetic and nuclear forces. But it seems to be some new, different kind of matter other than the matter we know and love. And it is characterized by primarily having a gravitational interaction.
When you speak about it having a gravitational factor of some sort, what are the clues that have led scientists to believe that it is out there?
Well, there are many clues. One of them is the speed of galaxies within galaxy clusters. And another clue is the speed of stars that are going around the centers of their galaxies, including our own. So a good analogy is our solar system. So you know how the planets will go around the sun. Other planets go around their suns, their stars. Well, stars inside of galaxies, the hundreds of billions of stars in each galaxy, they all revolve around the centers of their galaxies. So most if not all galaxies harbor a supermassive black hole at the center. So we're all revolving around, all the stars of any galaxy are all revolving around that central mass. And those speeds don't seem to be quite right, unless we assume there's some additional matter beyond what we can see in the luminous matter in the stars. And that by itself, though, doesn't definitively say there's more matter, because maybe we just don't understand gravity. And this goes back to the work of Vera Rubin, who did the seminal work on these galactic rotation curves. But there's so much more. There's the cosmic microwave background radiation and large-scale structure of the universe that give us other clues that also all point towards this extra matter.
So you just returned from South Dakota, where there's a lot of research on dark matter going on. What can you tell me about your trip there, and why were you out there?
So I work on the LZ dark matter experiment, and it has to be deployed deep underground, which seems strange because we were just talking about outer space. But the thing is, you have to remember Earth is in space, and so we're moving through the field of dark matter in our galaxy. And so one of the techniques that's used to look for dark matter is called direct detection. And I work on one of the largest, best experiments in the world, LZ, and is deployed deep underground in South Dakota in a former gold mine, home state gold mine, which is now SURF, the Sanford Underground Research Facility. That's where the LZ experiment is in order to get away from naturally occurring radiation from particles we know and love already through cosmic rays, for example, and now just the naturally occurring level of radiation of particles that's all around us. So that's why we have to deploy an experiment like LZ deep underground in order to look for dark matter.
So the detection experiments are going on to locate dark matter. Are you looking in just our own solar system, or our own galaxy, or in other galaxies further away?
So that's a great question. So we're looking in our galaxy because dark matter would be, it's concentrated where there are galaxies. It's everywhere in space, but it would be very hard to see something from great distances. But we can see, we should be able to see dark matter underground because its interactions are so rare that it passes through the nearly 1 mile of rock to get to the underground lab in South Dakota, whereas most cosmic rays can't do that. They still can, and that's why we still have, even underground, we are seeing cosmic radiation passing through nearly a mile of rock, but it's much rarer, of course, underground than on the surface. But if dark matter interacts primarily gravitationally and has only very weak other types of interactions, that means it should be able to pass through that nearly mile of rock above the underground lab without a problem and still make it all the way to the LZ detector.
So I'm just curious as to how this functions. It seems so foreign to me that equipment can map something out in the universe, one, without being able to see it visually, and two, I have no idea of the kind of equipment that actually can detect this cosmic radiation. So can you tell me about the technology that's actually involved in the LZ experiment and how it is able to detect this cosmic radiation?
So it's the type of technology we use is called the dual phase xenon time projection chamber. So basically it's a large thermos, to keep it cold, of liquid and gaseous xenon, some gaseous xenon on top of a large volume, nearly 10 tons of liquid xenon. Now, what's special about xenon, it's not the only technology for dark matter detection. There's argon, there's germanium, but they all share the same principle. And the idea is that a particle comes in and triggers something detectable. In the case of xenon, it's light. So you see ultraviolet light from interactions. And there's nothing special about the dark matter interaction that would preferentially cause a detection versus other kinds of particles, other kinds of radiation. That's, again, why we have to go deep underground and also build the detector out of extremely pure materials. So we're looking for tiny flashes of light above normal expected background. It's not like we're having no interactions, zero, and we're waiting around. We get interactions from naturally occurring alphas, betas, gammas, neutrons, particles like that that we already know and understand. You can't eliminate them completely, even going underground, building experiment out of pure materials. So what you need to do is simulate all the possible residual backgrounds you have, and you look for something that's statistically significant above that background noise.
So these particles that are actually passing through the Earth's crust to this detector, how small are they compared with other particles or other radiation that people on Earth are bombarded with constantly, coming from either sources on this planet or sources in space?
Well, if you're talking about physical size, we think that fundamental particles all have zero size, so there's no difference in size. I mean, unless something like string theory is correct, we think that particles that are fundamental are point-like. So there's no physical size difference between, for example, an electron and a dark matter particle. We think it's just zero size. It has no size. It's infinitely small. However, one way we quantify dark matter interaction is in units of surface area, which seems a little strange, but basically what we're doing is we're quantifying not a physical size, but it's a way of quantifying the probability of the interaction. So when we don't detect dark matter, we set a new limit on what the cross-section is for interaction. It's not a physical size, even though it has units of size, surface area. It's not a physical size, but it represents the probability of interaction. So the sizes we've already gotten to in terms of surface area of cross-section are already much smaller than the atoms of the xenon. So it's not a physical size, but it's simply a handy representation of the interaction probability of a dark matter particle with the xenon atoms.
How much dark matter is actually out there? Is this a very common phenomenon, or is it something that
obviously requires a search, but is like finding a needle in a haystack.
Well, most of the matter in the universe is dark matter, actually. Uh-huh. So it's roughly 85% or 90% of the matter. But if we also consider matter and energy, which we should consider equivalently, then it's about 25% of the total mass/energy of the universe, still a substantial fraction. Now, that being said, that is an average per unit volume over the observable universe. We think that here in our Milky Way galaxy, you think then it would be so plentiful and easy to detect. But we think the average locally is about, in units of energy, is about 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. So let me explain briefly what those units mean.
Yes, please.
And try to make some sense out of them. So a particle like the, let's put it in terms of something that our listeners may be more familiar with, the proton inside of every atom. Inside of every atom of every cell of your body, there are protons inside of the nuclei of atoms. A proton has a mass of about 1 GeV. And so this is a third of a GeV per cubic centimeter. A cubic centimeter is identical to a milliliter. So think of it as one third of a proton per milliliter. That's the local average density. We think somewhere around there, maybe a little bit higher, lower by tens of percent. That is not much. That's not much. So that is really hard in terms of detection, more so because that's an mass density or an energy density. But we don't know how much one dark matter particle weighs. And so if dark matter is very light, then there might be a lot of individual numbered dark matter particles. But if dark matter is very heavy, then there might be one dark matter particle in this room and one out by Pluto's orbit. So we know what the average mass energy density is. But because we don't know the mass of one dark matter particle, because we don't know what it is, it could be a very large number density or a very small number density.
Why do you believe it's so important to help solve this riddle? And what fascinates you about this research?
Well, several reasons. First is the fact that it's such a substantial fraction of the universe, as I discussed earlier. And the gravity provided by dark matter that is more plentiful than ordinary matter helped ensure that galaxies formed and stars and planets. So life might not even be possible without dark matter. That's how fundamental we think it is. And even putting that aside, which I think is really compelling, I think that we need to keep in mind that most technology we have today was once fundamental research. We have no idea what dark matter is good for, just like we don't know what the Higgs boson, the God particle, what's that good for other than advancing human knowledge? But advancing human knowledge very often leads to practical applications. Think about the discovery of antimatter in the 1930s. Who would have dreamed that we would be diagnosing cancer with antimatter in the modern era with PET scans? You know, antimatter was just checking a box. We made a discovery. Physicists were excited. Same thing could be said for electricity. Electricity was discovered. Who would have dreamed that this cute phenomenon, well, not necessarily cute, you know, also fatal, right, if you're electrically shocked, this phenomenon you study in the lab would be running our entire lives, right? Before the internet even, right? Electricity, you could put higher than the internet, you know, especially before the, just going back a few decades, is just running everything. You wouldn't have computers and internet without electricity first. We wouldn't have, you know, power plants. We wouldn't have, you know, refrigerators, dishwashers in our homes. And so dark matter is one of those things, though, that we can't even dream yet or imagine what it could possibly be useful for. So right now, it's just about pushing the horizons of human knowledge. But who knows what'll happen in a few centuries.
Matthew Sudeikis is a physics professor at the University at Albany. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Summer is nearly over, and while your tomato plants may be nearing the end of their season and your sunflowers may be setting, there's still plenty to do in the garden. The fall offers opportunities for gardeners not only to enjoy their harvest, but also begin planting and preparing for next year. Upstate New York-based Home Earth Alliance has a mission to educate and inspire people to cultivate sustainable yards and outdoor spaces. Recently, the nonprofit opened its latest venture, the Imagine Native Plant Farm in Glenmont. After an explosion of interest in native plants and home gardening during the COVID-19 pandemic, Home Earth Alliance says the new farm will help develop a local supply chain for native species and foster an understanding of natural ecosystems. To learn more, the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds toured the Imagine Native Plant Farm with Home Earth Alliance co-founder and ecological landscape designer, Kate Brittenham.
The more we did our own exploratory work trying to inspire people to have sustainable landscapes, the more it became clear to everybody involved within Home Earth Alliance that we needed to lower the access, the barrier of affordable native plants. And that goes for both people like homeowners, but as well as municipalities too, trying to encourage towns to do, you know, public gardens and stuff like that, or restoration projects. So that's where this kind of became clear to us that, okay, this is something we need to do and we can help. And there's a great demand to create a native plant supply chain within New York State, and we're working with other partners who would potentially be involved with that.
So how important are native plants to this region's environment?
Ooh, that's an interesting and really good question. Well, they are the basics of the food chain, essentially, with, you know, a few other things being beneath them. But, you know, without native plants, we don't have indigenous insects. Without indigenous insects, we don't have songbirds or anything else that would then consume them. There's a really wonderful professor out of University of Delaware called Dr. Doug Tallamy, who really kind of pioneered a lot of, or at least really raised the awareness level for a lot of people on the importance of native plants and the thousands, millennia-year-old relationships between plants and indigenous insects. Indigenous insects have co-evolved with plants, and so aren't specifically our native plants. And without them, they might be able to consume some other plants, but many of our indigenous species cannot. They are very specifically tied to our native plants, so they really can't consume anything else, so that they would die out if they didn't have those. And I alluded to songbirds. I believe I'm probably going to get this actual statistic incorrect, but like a single clutch of chickadees takes like 6,000 caterpillars, something like that, to actually form, to actually fledge. They rely more on caterpillars and insect larvae than they do, you know, seeds. We think of maybe birds go after seeds and berries, but they actually really need that critically as the most protein in it. So basically the entire trophic levels, all our ecosystems would collapse if we didn't have our native plants.
How dangerous are invasive plants to our environment and our habitats that we have in our region?
It's an interesting question to word, especially with specifically the noun dangerous, because I think in many ways we don't think of plants in those terminologies. You know, some people, you know, might even think that they are like sentient, you know, they don't have a voice, they don't seem to necessarily react in the way wildlife and animals do. So I think that's a really, to consider it that way is kind of an interesting idea. But invasive plant species, some are more problematic than others, but it goes back to what I mentioned about native plants specifically having that co-evolutionary relationship with our native wildlife. They don't have that relationship with invasive plants, and invasive plants, that's the term for a reason, they take over wide swaths of areas and they outcompete native flora. And that displaces wildlife. It basically starves them out of house and home, and it forces them to congregate in areas where there are native plants and then over-harvest those. We also do have an overabundance of deer in our area, too, which in tangent, at the same time, simultaneously, while we have invasive species, they're just both making the situation very difficult and worse.
Do you have a favorite native plant?
I do. Well, the problem is it changes. And it depends on like factors. I have a number of favorite native plants. I'm currently wearing one of them. Mm. The goldenrod is one of my favorites. A lot of people think it's a really aggressive plant. It is. It's very assertive. It's the word I like to use. And some people use the term invasive and apply it to native plants like goldenrod. It's not invasive, it is aggressive. And you have to know how to treat it properly. But there's various different species of goldenrod, and some are a little less aggressive than others. Rough goldenrod, Canada goldenrod, that's what I have in my hair right now, and that is a pretty assertive plant. It's still, however, like the best, one of the best plants for pollinators and for bees specifically this time of year. It's one of the longest, latest blooming. Goldenrods and asters kind of give that final push that they need, essentially, before winter.
How would you say plants restore health in our environment?
In a myriad of ways. I mean, mainly food, obviously. I mentioned like habitat and food for caterpillars, which is important because it supports the whole trophic levels. But they also, you know, are really important in that they help retain stormwater into the soil, prevent erosion. You know, sure, other plants could do that too, but they are adapted to our area. And the most important thing is that they are food. And I think critically, we haven't viewed gardens as that for a long time. We've just sort of thought of gardens as these aesthetic things that make us happy to look at and happy to be in, which is very important. That's, you know, a whole aspect of human health, but we're only thinking about human health and we're not thinking about maybe what they actually should be designed for. I've had many conversations and heard many stories from people over the years about having conversations with homeowners, clients in my line of work doing design, where they're like, well, I don't want anyone to eat my plants. Like, I don't, you know. But plants aren't furniture, they are food. And, you know, imagine you walked into a place and all you found out it was just all wax, you know, and you're starving. That's basically what we're doing to all of our wildlife.
So is there anything that the general public could do in terms of restoring and making their backyards more healthy?
Yeah. No, and I love the use of the word healthy, because that's really what we're trying to do, is healthy landscapes. Reduce your lawn. That's the first thing I say. If you have lawn, if you have just a front stoop, put out a planter that is full of pollinator plants. You know, change it out, take care of it, whatever you need to do. But start incrementally. It's okay to take it small and be kind and graceful to yourself as you do it. Join a garden club. Join some kind of group that is doing something and convince them, you know, let's think about native plants. Those are small things, and I know sometimes talking to officials can be really intimidating. And just planting, just get touch grass. Go out, you know, touch grass, like do some planting, get some, it's okay to be dirty, like to get some dirt on under the nails. It's really mentally rewarding, physically rewarding. And if you don't have that kind of access, demand it. We need to start making changes everywhere across the board. But I do believe that you can have your own little tiny green space no matter where you are.
That's Imagine Native Plant Farm and Home Earth Alliance co-founder Kate Brittenham speaking with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. High school football is back. For a bit of school spirit, we now head to Springfield, Massachusetts, where students and school officials recently welcomed a new football field as part of a larger project to add more athletic facilities to the area. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief James Polyalagopoulos reports.
This is a historic occasion, continued success on and off the field.
For the past year, work on the new Ted Plum Football Stadium off of Wilbraham Road has been coming together. With a synthetic turf field, bleachers that can seat well over 1,000, and a surrounding track. It was the initial phase of a three-phase project totaling at least $16 million. The first phase's completion got a proper kickoff, honoring the field's namesake, Mayor Dominic Sarno.
And he coached not only football, but he coached baseball and basketball. But he was known for his football days. 30 years he dedicated to the city of Springfield and to the student athletes.
For decades, Plum coached at what was then Springfield Trade High School, which eventually became the Roger L. Putnam Vocational Technical Academy. In 1970, Sarno says, a field was dedicated in Plum's honor, but nearly 40 years later, the land would give way to a new Putnam school building. About 16 years after the final games were played at the former facility, a new state-of-the-art sports complex now bears his name beside Duggan Academy. It hosted a special Mayor's Cup football game between Putnam and the High School of Commerce. On hand was Plum's extended family, including his son James, who told reporters the longtime coach would have loved to see the latest dedication.
Oh, he'd have been very happy. This is a testament to his 35 years of coaching the kids of Greater Springfield, and he'd be very proud of this, as we are too.
State and local officials remembered the coach from when they attended school in Springfield. 11th Hamden Representative Bud Williams recalled being told by Plum that he was too valuable to the school's basketball team to risk on the football field. Instead, he was offered a chance to help on the sidelines. When it came time for team bus travel, though, Williams couldn't afford the suit required of traveling players.
So I'm kind of dejected and upset and crying, and Willie Manzi, who was assistant coach at the time, get together with Coach Plum and Eddie Kozier, who was my head coach in basketball. They put some money together. They purchased my first suit that I ever owned in my whole life. True story. That's the character of Ted Plum.
On Friday, Putnam beat Commerce 36-6 on the new field, only the second of its kind in the city's school system, according to Ward 5 City Councilor LeVar Clickbruce, the other being by Central High School. With more additions to come in the project's later phases, the councilor says the 22-acre sports complex and park will be a community center of sorts.
I'm ecstatic. I wish I had this when I was growing up. Kids have a state-of-the-art facility. The football field, we have track and field, we have the basketball courts, we're going to have baseball diamonds, and soccer field as well, so it's multi-purpose. And the city gets to enjoy it, and also the community. We're going to have community walks for our seniors, senior group, so I think it's going to take on a life of its own. And again, like I said, it's like a community center.
According to Sarno, the first phase of the project totaled around $9.3 million. The project's second phase, slated to bring a new fitness area and upgrades to baseball, softball, and soccer fields, is expected to wrap up this fall, according to the city's 2024-28 capital improvement plan. The same report says the third phase, consisting of parking area improvements and other amenities, will begin in the summer of 2025 and finish the following fall. Reporting from Springfield, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1771. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.